This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for May 2011. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature poets in the current issue reading their work. This month, we're going to hear from Kay Ryan.
There are charms that forestall harm.
Fanny Howe.
Was this religious fire? And is this where it passed?
James Arthur.
Far more than in God, I believe in Cain.
And Sarah Lindsay.
This music pauses sometimes, but does not end.
We're also going to speak with Carolyn Forche about the poetry of witness.
Also in the May issue, we have an essay from Clive James in his ongoing series. This one's on product placement in modern poetry, and just to give you a little taste of it, the first sentence reads, "Early in the 20th century, E.E. Cummings was as hot against materialist society as only a poet living on a trust fund can be." Sort of typical Clive James. And he goes on to talk about the various uses of products and brand names in poetry, including in Frederick Seidel.
And we also have a piece by Robert Archambault about progress versus pluralism, which is a review of new books by Marjorie Perloff and the late Reginald Shepherd.
As for poetry, we've got new work from Dana Gioia, Franz Wright, and Wendy Vitalock, among others. But let's get right to our featured poets. Kay Ryan, as you might already have heard, has just won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for her book, The Best of It, New and Selected Poems.
As it happens, we recorded her on the day the Pulitzers were announced. Ryan told one of our producers, Posey Gruner, that she never really knows how her poems sound when she reads them out loud.
I think reading them, in a way, is a great distortion because it limits the emphases and it interprets them. And I want there to be everything that the reader needs on the page.
When Posey suggested that some poems, like Ginsberg's Howl, are best experienced orally, Ryan actually disagreed and brought up another poet she has a lot more in common with.
I don't think we want to hear Emily Dickinson's poems read. I mean, I don't. I would find it a real intrusion to hear her poems read. And I'm going to admit that my real interest is in written poetry and not Howl, not poems that you think, oh, this has got to be heard, because I like the theater of the mind. You know, I'm most interested in that voice of yours, Posey, that nobody can will ever hear, right? It's so intimate to you. And that's the kind of inner voice that I'm interested in talking with.
And that inner voice of the silent reader is what's required to fill in the spaces between Kay Ryan's spare, almost gnomic lines. Here's a poem called All You Did, where it's not at all clear who the you is or what you did.
All you did. There doesn't seem to be a crack. A higher pin cannot be set. Nor can you go back. You hadn't even known the face was vertical. All you did was walk into a room. The tipping up from flat was gradual, you must assume.
One of the reasons I think that Kay doesn't like for her poems to be read aloud, or doesn't, I guess that's not the right way to frame it, doesn't trust reading aloud of poems and wants them to exist on the page, is because on the page, her line breaks conform very much to often the awkwardness of what she's describing, and she will make very awkward pauses within her poems. For instance, in this poem, she's got A at the end of a line. She has U at the end of a line. All you did was walk into a room. The tipping up from flat was gradual. You know, all these awkward pauses. Right. That, in fact, if you did it in a reading, it would sound ridiculous.
Yeah.
But on the page, it mirrors the awkwardness of this action in this poem where you walk into a room and the emotional affect is suddenly much greater and steeper than you realized, right?
Yes, and the short lines, I've always thought of them as almost like the left-hand sides of poems, you know, like maybe there were longer lines and this thing gets cleaved in the middle, so we're left with the gnomic first beginnings of things. Or
that's an interesting way to think of it. Yeah,
Your mind starts supplying things that are missing, although all this said, what she does is very skillful, so that there doesn't seem is the first line, but that's a very deft first line. There doesn't seem to be a crack.
Right.
And even that there's end rhyme in her lines, like seem and the last word of the poem, assume, really does show that there are other qualities besides what's on the page. I mean, that's often the case that, you know, poets live on the page. Of course, that's how, for the most part, their works survive.
Right.
But the voice you hear in your head is a part of what is, as she describes, supplied to fill out the whole poem for you.
Yeah, well, Denise Levertov used to insist on those pauses because she said that the poem on the page was a score for the reading voice. Mm-hmm. But a lot of poets don't believe that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this poem, it's interesting that, like you say, that it starts with there doesn't seem to be a crack. And so you immediately think, well, then there is a crack.
Right. It's a funny thing to say.
And you think, well, a crack in what? What is she talking about in this poem? Yeah. And it seems her poems often do this, and they'll set up a metaphor where this seems to me to be about climbing. Like you're climbing up something. There's not a crack that you can reach to. A higher pin cannot be set. There's not something that you can fasten onto or, you know, get that next pin into. And then
you hadn't even known the face was vertical.
But then the whole poem shifts.
All you did was walk into a room.
Instead of on this steep peak, you're in a room.
Yeah.
And she often does that, where she'll have a metaphor that's some elaborate thing, and then suddenly it becomes a way of experiencing different kinds of emotions. You don't know what the emotion is in this poem, right?
Yeah. And different dimensions, almost literally. You know, the end of the poem, the tipping up from flat was gradual. Reminds me of this book they had us read when I was a kid. I don't know if people still do, called Flatlands. And it was supposed to illustrate the different dimensions that exist through geometry. It's a very clever book. It really is a great kid's book and an adult book too, serious book. And what I thought of here was that actual embodiment of different dimensions. The tipping up from flat was gradual. But you know, when somebody walks into a room, that is a new dimension. You know, there's suddenly a real person there, and all the dimensions of that human space or inhuman space can change when a person enters a room. That's all you have to do to change a space is be in a room.
Which is one way of reading the poem. Another is, say this is a marriage, and the kind of rift or the kind of, you know, the crack or whatever, you don't realize what peril you're in until it's too late.
Yeah.
Right? It's happened so gradually that suddenly that face is so damn steep, and you're like, oh my God, I can't hold on here.
Well, she's the expert poem of this verticality, if you want to call it that.
Yeah. Let's listen to another Kay Ryan poem, which is maybe a little easier to follow, but equally mysterious. This one is called Linens.
There are charms that forestall harm. The house bristles with opportunities for stasis. Refolding the linens along their creases, keeping the spoons and chairs in their right places. Nobody needs to witness one's exquisite care with the napkins, for the napkins to have been the act that made the fact unhappen.
You know, here too, maybe even more so in this poem, her beautiful reading of her own work slightly belies her feeling about doing it. She's a terrific reader of her work. Those luscious end rhymes are really terrific. And on the page, you see them, but it's quite different to hear them. And there's some serious rhymes here too, you know, charm and harm.
Right.
It's very deft for a poet to be able to pull off something like that. I mean, most of these rhymes just fall flat on their faces and fall right out of their chairs. But Kay Ryan is such a subtle and skillful user of these qualities in very short rhymes. A lot of times when poems have long lines, they careen into a kind of effect like a rhyme. And she's able to just chisel out these lines like that. Yeah, and yet they're still beautiful.
Yeah, what I love about this one is you point out the end rhymes. There's also these wonderful internal rhymes like creases and places where you can feel them crackling just like these things that she's folding. You know, very precise. And it's a kind of finical, nervous, maddening precision in this poem because, again, you feel that something is being fended off.
Yeah.
That there's some emotional, not calamity necessarily, but some emotional extremity that is being fended off. And it's being fended off both by this act of folding the napkins and by the sound of the poem.
Well, there's something almost Talmudic about that where, you know, all of the spoons and chairs have to be in their right places. I mean, this is almost a sense that if you can just in your domestic life put things in the right places,
then you'll be okay.
Nothing will hurt you.
right. It's very interesting to read this poem against that first one.
Yeah.
Unlike Kay Ryan, we have a number of poets in the May issue making their first appearance in the magazine, and James Arthur is one of them.
His first book, Charms Against Lightning, will be published by Copper Canyon Press. His poem in the May issue is called The Land of Nod, and it was inspired by the biblical story of Cain and Abel.
According to that story, after Cain murders Abel, God banishes him to a land east of Eden, which is called the Land of Nod.
But from what I understand, scholars today think that Nod in Hebrew just means to wander.
Here's James Arthur reading The Land of Nod.
Growing up, I barely knew the Bible, but read and reread the part when Cain drifted east or was drawn that way into a place of desolation, the land of Nod, there to begin with a wife of unknown origin, another race of men under the mark of God. As a boy, I thought Nod would be a place where the blue scillas would bloom gray, a country of the rack and screw, the serrated sword, where the very serving cups were bone. As a grown man, I've heard that Nod never was a nation of Cain's offspring or anyone, but a mistranslation of wander, so Cain could go wherever and be in Nod. Far more than in God, I believe in Cain, who destroyed his own brother, and therefore in any city could have his wish and be alone.
Well, it sounds like he grew up like I did, in the Bible Belt, and knowing Bible stories very well. And mm-hmm. what I particularly admire is the way the poem ends with this notion of irresoluteness. Mm-hmm. I mean, so what? Has he gotten his wish? And his wish, so he's granted his wish, which is godlessness in a way, but his wish renders him completely alone, completely solitary.
But that's the punishment, right. As well as the reward, maybe, in this case.
Right.
This is one of those poems, we get them once in a while, where, you know, we don't know who the poet is, and you see this poem, and you go, who is this?
Yeah.
How did they do that? This poem seems to me just to have come seamlessly from somebody's mind. It's very intense. You know, you go from those blue scillas that would bloom gray, which kind of sounds like an awful line of lyric poems. And what it's really talking about is a country of the rack and screw, the serrated sword, where the very serving cups were bone.
That's good.
That's good, good stuff.
Yeah. We're listening to a track called Bathing in the River by the Thai Elephant Orchestra. Now, these are actual elephants playing on instruments specifically designed for elephants. Who knew?
How do you design elephants? Well, you can't make this stuff up, but you can watch it on YouTube. And the elephants are directed by elephant conservationist Richard Lair and the composer David Soldier.
It's a group of elephants who are being helped to make money for their own preservation by recording and performing, and they have a couple of CDs out, and I've enjoyed mine very much.
That's Sarah Lindsay, who's meditated on the lives of animals before in our pages. In the May issue, she has two poems, and one is called Hollow Boom Soft Chime, the Thai Elephant Orchestra.
A sound of far-off thunder from instruments 10 feet away. Drums, a log, a gong of salvage metal. Chimes of little Isan bells, pipes in a row, sometimes a querulous harmonica. Inside the elephant orchestra's audience, bubbles form of shame and joy and burst. Did elephants look so sad and wise, a tourist thinks, her camera cold in her pocket, before we came to say they look sad and wise? Did mastodons have merry, unwrinkled faces? Hollow boom, soft chime, stamp of a padded foot, tingle of Renat, rattle of Anklung. This music pauses sometimes, but does not end. Pratida gently strokes the bells with a mallet. Pung and his mahout regard the gong. Haitun sways before two drums, bumping them, keeping time with her switching tail. Sales of recordings help pay for their thin enclosure of trampled grass. They have never lived free. Beside a dry African river, their wild brother lies, a punctured balloon, torn nerves trailing from the stumps of his tusks. Hollow boom, soft chime, scuff of a broad foot, sometimes rarely a blatting elephant voice. They seldom attend the instruments without being led to them, but once they've begun, often refuse to stop playing.
Well, I guess one of the things you have to do, which we've spoiled for anybody listening, is to decide in this poem whether there really is a Thai elephant orchestra. I mean, you could look at this poem and think that a poet has come up with a strange fantasy of some kind. But here it is, a real Thai elephant orchestra. And the challenge for the poet is to do something that complements the sound of what she's talking about here.
It's odd that you mentioned that, because it actually never occurred to me that it might be a parable, because I'd heard of this before. But mm-hmm. but now that you mention it, the poem has a parable feel to it.
Yeah.
Even though you know that it's real, it feels like a parable in a way. It feels odd, especially that end, that once they've started playing, they refuse to stop.
Yeah.
You know, there's some sort of impulse in the animal towards this music and some sort of connection that is human. It's moving.
Well, it's the impulse that poets have.
Right, yeah.
And they refuse to quit too. But yeah, when you read the poem, in the second stanza where it says, Prathita gently strokes the bells with a mallet, prung in his mouth, regard the gong, and so on. I mean, if you didn't know, you would think these are people, that it's a kind of orientalism at work in the poem, that somebody's kind of a tourist, you know, and they're spinning out these fabulous sounding names. But these are the names of these sad-eyed elephants.
Yeah.
Who have to play the music to earn the money for their own conservation. I mean, that's the kind of the moral, or one of the morals of the story.
It defends it. It's actually good that it's literal, because it defends it against that sort of anthropomorphism, that easy anthropomorphism, which would, in a way, corrupt the poem. You know, it's interesting that she won a prize from us a few years ago, one of the biggest prizes we give for a selection of poems that she published in the magazine, which we all thought were just fantastic.
Yeah.
And she wrote me a note after that and said that one of the things that she had bought with the money was a painting done by elephants.
Yeah.
So she's a patron of the arts of elephants, right? Fanny Howe is the author of many books of poetry, fiction, and essays. A few years ago, she won the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize for Lifetime Achievement. That's an award that we give out here at the Poetry Foundation. In the past few years, we've published some of her prose meditations, and in fact, we've got one that we're going to publish in an upcoming issue. But this month, we have a poem from her.
And it's not an easy poem. Fanny Howe's poetry is known for its associative images and sound, and this one's no exception. It's called What Did You See? It's dedicated to someone named Peter S. That's S period. And until we recorded her, we didn't know that the mysterious Peter S. was in fact
the painter Peter Sacks.
The South African-born Harvard professor Peter Sacks is a poet and a scholar as well as a painter. And in fact, he turned to painting in his 40s and now considers it his primary art.
I went to his show in New York about a year and a half ago and was blown away by the paintings and took notes and then ran home and wrote this poem.
Wow, that's a little bit like, you know, Keats running home after looking into Chapman's Homer, that kind of excitement when you see something. You know, you can see Peter Sacks' artwork online. As we've said, he's turned to painting very, very seriously. But his background as a poet and critic and teacher is quite substantial. He's written a critical work about elegy, and there are a lot of textures in his poems and in his criticism and in all the things he does that have found a new dimension in these visual artworks.
They can be difficult to see online simply because they are very densely textured. But you do get a feel for them, and they're oddly put together. They're oil and acrylic with burnt linen. At least that's the ones that Fanny is talking about here. All these paintings have these stretches of burnt linen in them, which sounds bizarre, but is actually incredibly beautiful and creates an effect that's at once completely material and ineffable. You can see why it would appeal to Fanny Howe so much. Here she is. Here's Fanny Howe reading What Did You See?
I saw the shrouds of prisoners, like baptismal gowns, buried outside the cemetery. On the canvas, frills exhaled, singed wool and cardboard. The angels arrived as lace, took notes, then stuck. Awful residue from a small cut. The veil has been ripped from the skin where it was burned in. The skin is the veil, the baby material, imprinted on as if one dropped the handkerchief and it was one's wrist. The cuff is frightening, stuffed onto oil. Water stains might fence its ghost in. The barbed wire complex I understand, winged and flattened at the same time, poor things. Some leftover specters of blood. Remember Blake's figures like columns with heads looking around for God? When things are not as random as they seem. The article of clothing is only half there. It's not full. But when it falls forward, it is. terrible emptiness of the spread neckline and little sleeve, half-cooked squares. Was this religious fire, and is this where it passed? Maybe they're floating on water of paint, pool-sized, blue and ridged, like foam. You would have to fly to see them flat as a map, the rib and hem, rained on for eons, Noah's children, floating forms. Angels die? It's a frightening miracle, because here they are. The upper God has let them drop, like centuries, into space. And I recognize them.
I love that ending. It's so fanny. Yeah. You know, it's so like her work, which has an austerity to it, but then also this ecstatic quality which suddenly bursts through.
And yeah, it's like the end of the process is uplift.
Yeah, and I also love that someone could, Fanny, I don't know how old she is, but she might, she's been around a long time. And if you've practiced art for a long time, you realize how hard it is to sustain that early enthusiasm for art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how deadened you can become. And there is nothing deadened in her. You know, she's still wide open to these experiences, which sometimes, it leaves her poems wide open too. This can be a very difficult poem to interpret.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this poem was to Peter Sachs when I...
I didn't either. I thought it was maybe Peter Sheldahl, the art critic, or somebody like that. You know,
right.
You're always trying to guess what's going on. And in this poem, you sort of have to guess right off the bat, because as a genre, poems about artworks can be difficult, and the big question is, do you need that artwork in front of you to appreciate or understand the poem?
Mm-hmm.
And she's just taking it head on here, describing the painting, but more than describing it, just sort of interacting with it.
Yeah,
and you don't have it in front of you.
Well, she creates something completely different. I think if you read the poem closely, it's obvious it is about an artwork.
Mm-hmm.
She says on the canvas, and she talks about the strokes and various things like that.
Yeah,
that much is obvious, but I would say that yes, the poem exists without the artwork, but it is also much easier to interpret if you've seen the artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes a lot more sense.
I mean, the poem is complicated because what it's doing and what it's about, those are all complicated things. But in a funny way, she helps the reader by asking questions because, you would ask questions. The first one, obviously, is the title, What Did You See?
Yeah.
Which is a very elemental thing, but some of the questions are really complicated and intriguing, like...
Remember Blake's figures like columns with heads looking around for God?
And you don't actually have to remember them.
Right.
I didn't
right.
remember
you
them
You don't
personally.
Walk around remembering
right.
things like that.
I mean, I think she takes care of that. The answer is is in the question.
Yeah.
I like the way that this poem is... It takes place on the border between suffering and sanctity, like so much of her work. Say those first two lines, I saw the shrouds of prisoners, but they're like baptismal gowns.
Yeah.
So this weird quality of suffering being the very thing that leads us towards the sacred, and that's really her work as a whole. Carolyn Forché is well known for coining the term poetry of witness. Her 1981 book, The Country Between Us, comes out of her experience as a human rights activist in El Salvador during the Civil War there.
And her 1993 anthology, Against Forgetting, 20th Century Poetry of Witness, pretty much single-handedly defined a poetic mode that had once been lumped together with political poetry.
Until this year, Carolyn Forché had never been published in Poetry Magazine, and we've been trying hard to make up for that. We published poems by her in the February and March issues, and we featured her in the March podcast.
And for the May issue, she revisits the idea of the poetry of witness. She's written an essay about where this term comes from, what she means by it, and what distinguishes it from other ways of writing and reading poetry.
Carolyn Forché joins us by phone from her home in Washington, D.C. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello.
When you said about collecting and choosing these poems from various languages and traditions for that anthology, Against Forgetting, what exactly were you looking for? It wasn't exactly just political poems, was it?
No, I went about collecting the work in response to debates that arose in the early 80s regarding the relationship between the poet and the state, poetry and politics, the responsibility of the poet, and so on. I was frustrated with the discussions, actually, because they seemed reductive and simplistic. And so I went to the library to discover what poets in other countries had written in the aftermath of experiencing warfare, imprisonment, exile, and so on.
One of the intriguing things you say in your essay is that, in your sense of the term poetry of witness, it's a mode of reading rather than of writing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I realized as people were reading the anthology that they imagined that one could become a poet of witness, that this was some kind of identity acquired by poets who had suffered conditions of extremity. And I also then realized that I could be mistakenly read as prescribing a way of writing poetry, or that this might be a new way of writing political poetry, or another name for political poetry. And actually, the idea of witness comes out of theological and philosophical thought and deliberations over the past decades in the aftermath of the Shoah and the Second World War. I was conceiving of poetry of witness as a mode of reading poetry marked indelibly, really, and legibly by the extremity endured by the writer. I was resisting this idea of imagining it as a way to write or as an identity to become or to inhabit or to take upon oneself.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like your cat wants to get in on the discussion.
You know what that is? That's a parrot.
Oh, really?
You know, on the rest of the podcast, we already have a Thai elephant orchestra, this fits into our theme this month.
She's an Amazon Blue Front, and when I'm on the telephone, she gets very chatty.
Really? No, that's great. No, let's stay with the parrot.
Sure. What can poetry do that journalism can't?
Well, that was interesting, because when Leonel Gomez-Vidas invited me to El Salvador, I suggested he invite a journalist in my place. And he said he didn't want a journalist. But what's different? Everything is different. The journalist arrives into a very complex situation and attempts to simplify it and clarify it for usually an outside audience. You know, a poet is practicing literary art. A poet could be in the midst of war and never write about it, never be able to write about it. One may never write about what affects us most deeply, or what we might imagine affects us most deeply. We don't have a great deal of choice about what we write about. A journalist can decide to write a story about a particular event. A poet doesn't decide this. A poet sits before a blank piece of paper and begins.
You mentioned El Salvador a minute ago, and you know, much of your poetry and the poems in Against Forgetting as well are attempts to come to terms with evil. And I wonder, do you remember the first time that you personally encountered evil, and was it there in El Salvador?
Well, in the very deep sense, probably yes. I, of course, had all of the experiences and terrors of childhood that one has, but it was in El Salvador that I was confronted by a force that intended grave harm to others indiscriminately and absolutely. And there was also something else. Not only was it a murderous regime, but the perpetrators of these crimes were engaged in attempting to instill terrible fear in everyone through mutilation, torture, and so on. That so you wouldn't just come upon the dead, you would come upon the mutilated dead. And so there was fear not only of dying, but of dying horribly and slowly. And this kind of brutality was, for me, an extreme form. It was evil incarnate. It was something that was quite beyond my experience until then.
You know, it's striking and even refreshing that you say nothing about the therapeutic effects of writing or reading the poetry of witness. I wonder. Sometimes
I'm sorry because I believe that many people turn to poetry for healing and consolation, and, mm-hmm. and I'm very happy that it can have that effect at times. But I don't believe that we, as we say in this culture, achieve closure. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that we get over things. I don't believe that anything is ever over. I think we live on, and we live in the aftermath of what happened, and we do the best we can, and we attempt to make of what has happened to us something good for others. But we're living really in the actual presence of what I like to think of as the debris field, of the wreckage, of whatever terrible thing has transpired. So we don't really live after something. We live in its aftermath. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a certain release when one writes, but then if something has happened to you and you write about it, it's, you enter a kind of spiraling region of reliving and reprocessing and reimagining, and you return always to the same place, perhaps a little differently. It's a long, lifelong process, so we don't really, the poem doesn't heal us. It's not meant to. The poem is meant to be a poem in the world and in language, and to be a force in language in the deep, in a very deep, very special sense. So I don't look for consolation in the work, and I don't, and I'm not always sure that what we imagine as consolation is in fact actually true. I think that what happens is when we read a poem, we marshal within ourselves a certain sense of the salvific and a sense of comfort and release that we associate with the poem we've read.
Well, thanks so much, Carolyn, for talking to us today.
All right, you're welcome.
Carolyn Forché directs the Lannan Center for Poetics and Social Practice at Georgetown University. She's written 4 books of poems. Her most recent is called Blue Hour.
You can read everything you heard on this program in the May issue of the magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.